Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Between Seasons special mini-series. We're just getting ready the last few episodes of season 5. In the meantime, though, I am your ginger host, Mackenzie, and since everybody loved what we did with Schmigadoon, and the new retail season, Schmigacago, where we did a episode-by-episode breakdown of all the fun musical Easter eggs and stuff like that, we decided that it would be fun to do another show. So we went back through the catalog of other great musical TV shows. And obviously there's Smash, there's Glee, but one that's always held a special place in my heart is a little show that was only ran for 2 short seasons. And it was a kind of a Camelot meets Disney meets Spamalot type show. And it is none other than Galavant.
Back in days of old, there was a legend told about a hero known as Galavant.
Square jaw and perfect hair.
Call me like to them.
There was no hero quite like Galavant.
Tough, plus every other manly value.
And joining me on this adventure, as it were, all the way to Valencia and back with pirates and the monks and, you know, Cid and Oi, What a Night and all that good stuff, is none other than the gentleman who joined me for 3 trips through Onatevka. You sat with us all the way through that 3-hour commentary. It is none other than the wonderful Ryan Barakovich. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Mac. What an intro. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I am ready to dive back into this show. This is something that you and I have talked about doing other mini-series, because if you haven't gone over to Cup of Hemlock, the YouTube channel that we have where we are co-artistic producers, you may not have heard, but Ryan and I did a whole mini-series of the RSC Nicholas Nickleby plus a review of the Charlie Hunnam film adaptation as well. And so Ryan and I have been down this road before going on miniseries deep dives. And so when I was looking for someone to join me on this 2-season adventure, I decided that the only person who could be the Cid to my Galavant is none other than Ryan. So Ryan, welcome aboard.
Yes.
Welcome.
So good to be back in another journey. Like, also, I don't know if Nicholas Nickleby is news to your Before the Downbeat audience, we talk a lot about Les Mis in that series. So
we do.
Fans of musicals. Yeah, fans of musicals might find that there's more that they might be interested in that series,
yes,
too. But yeah, I'm really happy to talk about Galavant. I love this show. I've seen it all the way through twice. And now it's very funny that while I was watching this pilot episode again for now the 3rd time today, in preparation for this, it occurred to me that this show is so bingeable that it's actually going to be tough watching it at weekly intervals for this as we're going to be doing it, because I feel like the 2 previous times I've watched this, I've just like plowed through it in like 3 or 4 sittings tops, because they're short episodes. They're like 20 minutes each.
Yeah,
we're probably going to talk about it for like at least 3 times the length of each episode in each of these commentary episodes that we're doing. But yeah, it is a very conducive to binging show. So it'll, you know, it's going to be a good exercise in restraint to talk about it in these small little bursts and doses here.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, Ryan, so why don't you tell us kind of how you found this show? Because I mean, you have professed that you're not the most biggest musical connoisseur in the world. So how did you come across this kind of musical fairy tale show?
So I feel like that whole musical, like me being the guy who doesn't like musicals, that's probably not a fair assessment. No. And again, I do. I like musicals a lot. I have said before, and more so on the Cup than here on Before the Downbeat, that I am musically illiterate. I am completely tone deaf. I have no aptitude for, like, you know, music theory, understanding music. I was never able to play any instruments. I cannot carry a tune to save my life. So musicals are something that I enjoy, especially like ones that I enjoy. I enjoy Circular Logic right there. You know,
yes,
don't love all musicals, but who does really? But for the most part, I would just say that despite enjoying musicals, I am incapable of being a connoisseur of musicals. And as somebody who, you know, is staking his career on expertise in various forms of theater, you know, it's not something that I would ever confidently be able to claim expertise about. So I just kind of, you know, lack a lot of knowledge about musicals. I wouldn't know how to analyze the musical side of them to save my life. Yes. So, yeah, and of course I hated Oklahoma, which I know puts, you know, an asterisk on my credibility. And that's not even fully true. I didn't hate it. I was just baffled by so much of it. You can go over to our cup episode.
It's the first musical after Showboat. It's really the first proper musical of the Golden Age. So it definitely was a first attempt at what would become a much more refined art form.
Yes.
And that whole ending, we will get into.
Well, watch our Cup episode about it's Oklahoma if you want to really see good. My brain short circuit at the plot of Oklahoma. But to now, with all that preamble set up, yes. I guess to your question, how I came to Gallivant, I did actually miss the boat on it when it was originally airing weekly on ABC, it was, right?
Yes.
I think I was aware of it at the time, but just kind of, you know, didn't think much of it. This is a show. This looks like a thing. Maybe I'll watch that one day.
So and you're the reason why it got canceled.
I wish, because it got canceled prematurely, I really, now, once I did eventually watch it, I wished I had been part of the hype squad at the time and maybe writing and signing petitions to keep it on the air as people do. But actually, it's only a few years ago, actually, that I watched it for the first time. It was actually, oddly enough, somebody I had met on OkCupid, I believe, online dating, who's just, you know, we were talking, we went on a few dates, and she was like, oh, yeah, you're a theater kid. Surely you've seen Gallivant. And I was like, no, I never have. So she, you know, somebody who I did not continue dating long term, but introduced me to this show, and I've loved it ever since.
Well, thank you to that person.
Yes. And then I've since rewatched it with my current partner, Jill, also of Cup of Hemlock, because she had never seen it either. I'm like, you're a theater kid. You need to watch Gallivant, because
absolutely
fans of this show, as I think we can all attest, tend to be pretty evangelical about it. Is we should all watch this show.
Yes.
We might not be able to save it from oblivion, but we can enjoy these two pretty great seasons that we got of it.
Exactly. Yeah, amazing. Yeah, I mean, for me, I forget how I heard of it. I think, well, this came out while you and I were in our, I think it was our last year at York, because it came out 2015. So it was our third year at York in the winter season it came out. And it's one of those things where I heard the title song. That's how it came out first, was that because I follow Alan Menken, who is one of the songwriters for the show, and he was heavily promoted on the show because he is Disney royalty, and this is very much of the Disney brand, ABC. So they were all about touting his credits on there. And so they were playing the title song. And I mean, there's the great part of the opening of season two where they talk about how catchy the tune is, even though it never won an Emmy. But, you know, it's one of those things where I heard the title song and went, okay, I gotta watch this. This is actually very catchy, very fun. And I'm intrigued by this. And so, you know, this is kind of where I started. And then, you know, I followed along. Unfortunately, season two, I don't know why, but I couldn't get the episodes the same way. So I kind of had to resort to backdoor watches. But because it wasn't as popular as other shows, the upload streams of the free backdoor content was not as many. So trying to catch the episodes as they were coming in season two was much harder, sadly. But season one, I was there every week for it. And I mean, it just wowed me every time, because you think after watching the first episode, it's going to be very traditional, kind of Into the Woods meets Camelot meets Spamalot type show.
Princess Bride, I think, is probably the biggest influence on it, recognizably.
Yes, Princess Bride. Yes, the Princess Bride elements too. And then, but then by the second episode, you got like modern day kind of pop sounding songs in there as well. But it's really just a fun, well-written show. So I've gone back to it a few times as well, just because it is just a hoot to always kind of check it out.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that you specifically mentioned like Menken's influence on as being like a big part of what drew you to it, because it's funny, me going into it the first time, like watching it having been aware that, oh yeah, this is a show that people mm-hmm. I know like, but I actually didn't know anything about like any of the pedigree of who was involved. Like I obviously know Alan Menken, but I didn't know yes. that, oh, he wrote the music for this. That's mm-hmm. amazing. And like Dan Fogelman, of course, is like mm-hmm. the big creative mind behind this. Like, I don't know, I'm a big sucker for This Is Us. I think that show, yeah. you know, isn't always great, but when it is great, it is really, when it's good, it's good. Mm-hmm. He also, yeah, Dan Fogelman wrote the screenplays for Cars and Tangled. And
so Tangled's good, Cars not so much.
Yeah, people tend to be down on Cars because it's the one Pixar franchise that's based in about NASCAR, which people who tend to be, you know, big fans of, you know, what we could just say, like, classic animation nerd topics tend to be pretty down on things that the, you know, white lower class people tend to enjoy, like NASCAR. So I feel like that it gets an unfair reputation. But Cars is, it's a pretty decent, you know, movie. We don't need to yeah. litigate Cars here. But yeah, like, I don't know, if there's one big stain on Fogelman's career, in my opinion, it's Life Itself, which is just a big awkward mess of a movie. It's basically This Is Us, the movie. It came out a few seasons to This Is Us. It's not
wasn't
actually
Andy Patinkin in that one?
He was. Yes, he was.
I remember my parents seeing this and went, this is very cheesy.
Yeah, like
that makes sense. It's This Is Us guy.
Mr. Fogelman, if you are watching this, clearly, you know, thanks for tuning in. Clearly, we are big fans of your work here.
Yes.
But yeah, you know, don't take anything I say or either of us say about Life Itself as a ding against your... something I do appreciate about that movie and kind of just about mm-hmm. everything you do, Mr. Fogelman, speaking to you yeah. personally, is you take big risks, big bold swings, and sometimes mm-hmm. they work, other times they don't. And I think this show, Gallivant, is a great example of something that maybe people didn't really appreciate in its time, but has mm-hmm. clearly developed a bit of a cult following in its wake, and those risks do pay off. So let's yes. talk about Gallivant.
I would say so. Let's do it. So, Ryan, as we did with Nicholas Nickleby, you are our plot summary
sure.
kind of go-to guy. So give us the plot summary of season one, episode one. What is it?
Yeah, like, plot summary feels so strange for this because I, like, is anybody watching this who hasn't watched Gallivant? And if so, is it, you know, am I being...
Potentially, we are a global show.
Well, I know it. And the question then becomes, like, how granular do I get? Because I don't want to spoil it for people who think this sounds cool and then might actually watch it. And I don't want to be redundant for people who have seen it and know everything. So I
would say give us a hybrid elevator pitch
with
like extra details sprinkled in because you get stuck on a few floors along the way.
All right, I'll try my best on this great, great metaphor you just put there.
Thank you.
So Gallivant begins with a fun opening number that introduces us to the brave, heroic knight of Gallivant, mm-hmm. who's just like the coolest guy. He's the best trained knight in...
He's like Lancelot.
He's pretty much Lancelot, yeah.
Yeah, he's Lancelot.
Yeah. So he's just like the best of the best. You know, people sing songs about him. That is his
reputation. Yeah, Cajoni's out to there.
Yes. Okay. I'm not going to do beat by beat every lyric of the song praising him. But yes, that is one of them. Yeah. And yeah, over the course of this introductory number, we are introduced to Maddalena, the woman he's in love with. And they mm-hmm. have this very spicy relationship. And
they
then,
do. I mean, yes. Who would have thought an ABC were like first song in, like they're going orgasmic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty bold on a Disney-owned property.
Yes.
So then one day when they're purchasing a baby piglet, it's very unclear why that detail's there, but I kind of love it. King Richard shows up in their village,
yes.
and he wishes Maddalena to marry him and has her kidnapped into doing so. So right off the bat, very Princess Bride type setup
yes.
here. And our hero needs to stop the wedding before it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's showing up to the wedding. He's about to object. He does a big speech about love when he gets there. But then our first big twist happens, which and this was the moment in my first viewing where I kind of like perked my ears. I'm like, okay, this is actually different. This mm-hmm. isn't what I was expecting in the best possible way. Maddalena says, you know what, Gal, I think you're great, but... You know, I'm going to marry King Richard, not because I love him, just because, you know, money and power seems pretty persuasive, actually. So big gut punch. Okay, didn't think that's where this was going, but neat. And then we cut to 1 year later, and poor Gallivant has been heartbroken. He has taken on a squire named Cid, who we don't get to see a lot of in this first episode, but he's fun. We'll get to mm-hmm. know him more over the course mm-hmm. of the other episodes.
Yes.
And yeah, he's Gallivant is basically in a sad depression hole. He's drinking a lot. He has no money.
20 kegs a day.
Yeah, 20 kegs a day. It's good. Yeah. Even though I just rewatched the episode this morning, you remember all the fun little jokes and details better than I do. So keep them coming. So then who comes to visit him? Why, it's Princess Isabella, Maria, Elisabetta. She has a whole long sequence of names, but we call her Isabella, or Izzy for short. And yes, she is from the Kingdom of Valencia.
Yeah.
And she has come to seek Gallivant's services to help liberate her kingdom, or her family's kingdom, from an oppressive king who has taken it over. And because Gallivant, you know, has such a great reputation of being this great noble hero knight, so only he can come. And she brings the Jewel of Valencia, which is their family's crowned heirloom, as payment for his mercenary services. But because he's been so sad and depressed and put on some weight, I suppose, even though he looks fine, but they seem to comment on that a lot since, you know, this last heartbreaking adventure, he's not interested in helping. He's out of the damsel in distress game. So this is, again, thing number two that starts getting pretty interesting and, again, perked up my ears on a first viewing of, okay, this is interesting. We have Isabella telling this story to Gallivant, and then it cuts back and forth between her telling it in the present to 2 months earlier of the takeover of her kingdom. And who happens to be leading this takeover? Why, it's King Richard and his new queen, Maddalena. You know, and they've
and come. Gareth.
Yes, Gareth. Right. I haven't mentioned Gareth yet, because Gareth, kind of similar to Cid, is a character who we don't get like a great deep dive in this first episode, but is very fun, and we're going to have a great time with him.
Yes.
And I mean, I have more to say about Gareth, but we'll come back to that as it becomes organic. But yes, Gareth is King Richard's right hand thug bodyguard man, and he's great.
He's the man with six fingers.
Yes, he is.
He's Count Rugen.
He's also the Juggernaut, bitch.
I was about to say, he's the Juggernaut.
Yeah, Vinnie Jones, who plays him, was Juggernaut in X-Men The Last Stand, which is great.
Yes, he was.
And I believe he's also like a soccer player or
former
something.
Rugby player.
Okay, cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
I think he's also in Ted Lasso as well.
Which I have not seen. People have been telling me it's good, but I
think he was good too.
Cool. Put that on the list for something else.
He also was Elementary, The Arrow, a whole bunch of stuff.
Cool. Okay, yeah. So anyway, that was our little Gareth appreciation moment there, but back to the plot summary. Yeah, so Richard and Maddalena have taken over the Kingdom of Valencia because Maddalena just wants the Jewel of Valencia for herself. She's very petty and materialistic, and basically Richard feels inadequate that she keeps saying that, oh, Gallivant was so much better than you. And so he's basically just doing anything he can to try to impress her, including trying to get the Jewel of Valencia.
She's taken a vow of chastity against
him. Vow of chastity, which we know that she is not good at keeping. One, because she was not chaste before their wedding. And two, because of one of my other favorite characters, the Jester, who is the Jester in King Richard's court. And Maddalena is having an affair with him. And it's very funny, and it's happening right underneath Richard's nose, and he has
and
no idea.
And he's the main singer.
Well, he is, which is revealed kind of at the end of this episode, that he's been the one singing the Gallivant song from the beginning. Yeah. Yeah, the Jester's fun. Again, we will learn more about him as the episodes go on, but suffice it to say, all you need to know now is that he is carrying on an affair with Maddalena, and Richard has no idea. So, speaking of characters I love, we are also introduced to the chef, who we later find out his name is Vincenzo, but we'll just call him Chef for now, because he's this like timid little boy. I have no idea how old this actor was when he played the role, but he looks very young, and all the previous chefs in his family, his father and grandfather, etc., had all been killed by Richard because they did something wrong with the cooking. So just like every time he's on screen, like his eyes are bugging out. He's afraid that like one bad move and he is dead. He's clearly
he's kind of like the LeFou. To Richard and Gareth's Gaston kind of type.
Yeah. And well, that's certainly what he becomes over the course of certainly this first season. But like, this was, again, just another thing that perked my interest in this first viewing, or my first viewing of this, was that this is just such a funny character. And I had no idea that he would become central to the plot. Yeah. It was just that his presence was just like, Richard is this big baby man-child king is just so reckless, and if his mutton is a little under or overcooked, he will just have his cook killed, and that seeing these scenes unfold from the perspective of the cook really just, like, keeps you invested.
My favorite chef moment is at the end when they're doing all the cutaways as they're singing the final reprise, and you just got the chef doing the bit of a pop to himself in the kitchen.
Yes, he's great. We love Chef. Chef is going to be fun over the course of these two seasons. Okay, so we're at this, like, 2 month earlier flashback where Isabella's been hiding in the basement with the Jewel of Valencia while Richard is threatening to destroy the whole kingdom so he can get the jewel.
He's already massacred people. He's already said that he's killing innocent villagers. He hasn't killed the royal family yet.
He hasn't. But that's the next step. Villagers.
Yeah, exactly.
So while Madalena's off, you know, cavorting with the jester, Richard and Gareth are trying very hard to convince them to give up the jewel. And when Isabella...
It's priceless.
Yes, it's the priceless Jewel of Valencia. It's their, you know, their whole kingdom is all about it. So Isabella is found out. We find out in a very climactic moment. And, you know, they find the jewel. But because Richard feels that he'll never get Madalena's respect unless he kills Galavant, he decides that I could just, you know, take the jewel and give that and see if that'll please Madalena. But instead, what he's going to do is send Isabella to Galavant to lure him back to the kingdom so they can duel. And Richard believes he can defeat Galavant and that'll finally get his wife's respect. And the way these are cross-cut, I'm probably not doing it justice in the summary, but it's a very good, poignant reveal that when she's telling Galavant in the present about how Richard has taken over the kingdom, and that's what finally gets Galavant on board, is that, oh, Richard, why didn't you tell me earlier? And that Madalena is there too, and she, you know, there's a clever wordplay.
She is crying for Galavant.
Yes.
Calling out for Gal in the night as Izzy hears the lovemaking under the floor.
Exactly.
Even though we know that's not true.
Yes. So Galavant hears that, my enemy is the one who took over your kingdom, and I can still save my damsel. That's what gets him on board with the quest.
That is a noble cause.
Yeah.
In the words of Miracle Max.
Exactly. So he's on board. He's going to join Izzy on the quest. But the audience, have a little great piece of information here, is that this is a setup. And that Izzy, at least at this stage, does not appear that she can be trusted. We understand why she's deceiving him. It's to save her family. But she is going to be leading him into a trap. And
that's right.
And that's basically this episode. It's very much just the introduction, setting up the backstory and the premise of the quest he's going to be on, with letting the audience have a little bit of dramatic irony about, oh, he's going into a trap. And that's pretty much episode one.
That is the episode one summary. Well done, Ryan. Well done. And I mean, we've alluded to some of our main cast, so I think we should give him a chance to give him a bit of a shout out. So we have Joshua Sesse as Sir Gary Galavant.
Yeah, we don't learn that his name is Gary until much later.
Yes, yes.
He's just Galavant at this point.
He is just Galavant. Kind of like just Kramer.
Yes.
Yes. So what'd you think of Galavant? Or Joshua's portrayal of Galavant?
Yeah, Galavant is great. The whole show hangs on him. He is just the right amount of charismatic, but also arrogant. You know, you believe that he was truly this great warrior, but we kind of meet him all washed up, at least for like the main thrust of the series. And we kind of have to see him get his groove back. He does a great job. He's just kind of the right amount of period meets contemporary for this trick to kind of work. It's funny, we'll talk about this when we get to season two, but in season two begins with a change of facial hair for him, and there's a joke in that about how it's more period accurate, so I'm guessing they got some complaints about season one that his kind of scruffy half beard was sort of not quite suiting the period, so they made a point of improving that for season two. But yeah, he is the perfect protagonist for the series that, you know, we like him from the start and we can sympathize with where he's coming from, but we see that you have a lot of growth to do on this hero's journey, and we look forward to seeing you find it along the way.
You're off on a hero's journey. We'll get into that song next episode.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I did not know this performer, Joshua, before Galavant, and oh my goodness, this man is so charismatic. Like, how has no other like big movie franchise snap that guy up? Like MCU, DCEU, like, he could so play someone like a Captain Britain or, like, you know, any type of those very square-jawed heroic figures. He's very Henry Cavill. And I mean, he really is kind of playing the role of Lancelot, because this whole show is very kind of, as I said, Spamalot meets Princess Bride meets Disney. I forget some of the others.
That's just a whole
It's a whole smorgasbord. Because once again, this is a very self-aware, slightly satirical series. And so, I mean, he's playing kind of the role of Lancelot in this. And if you know Camelot, the opening song for Lancelot is C'est Moi.
Where in the world is there in the world a man so extraordinaire? C'est moi, I'm forced to admit, 'tis I humbly reply. That mortal who these marvels can do, c'est moi, 'tis I.
And his whole song as he's introducing himself is, who could be the best knight of the round table? Well, it's me, because I can, you know, leap over every wall I climb. Like, you know, I can swim a moat in record time. And that's the same type of area we find this Gallivant in, is that he's very much kind of the guy, and just the swagger that Joshua has, particularly when he's storming through the castle, killing them, but he's kind of knocking out the guards along the way.
Yeah.
And
I suggest you fall.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Exactly. Like, that just kind of ego is great. And then you see kind of just the utter despair that this man goes into when he and then he actually has a really sympathetic story of, I didn't grow up with a lot of love, so when I did fall in love for the first time, I fell really hard. And you know, I've kind of gone into my depression spiral here. I'm like, okay, so you're not just a hunk. You are a hunk with emotions, and you have some backstory that we will get much more into in season two. Mm-hmm. Season one very much kind of stays in the present, doesn't really delve too much into his family backstory. But the biggest thing is we learn is that, yeah, his mother and father didn't have a loving marriage. And so he kind of swore off romance until he met Madalena. And then, you know, Madalena betrays him, and that kind of really just breaks his heart. And so he's kind of in this down in the dumps, you know, it's more than he can bear. More beer? No. You know, so that's the thing there, where he's really kind of sets his character up for a really good journey in this episode. And he definitely is the charismatic leading man that's going to carry this show forward. And he's got such a great sense of humor. I mean, there's a really great Gallivant reprise where Madeleine's Izzy's trying to convince him to join the quest, and he's kind of cutting her off and giving all this side lib commentary about stuff, and he's really hitting his comedic marks on this. Uh-huh. So it's really well done. Yeah. So yeah, he definitely is a very good lead of the show.
It's something interesting you said about how, mm-hmm, like, you've never seen him like outside of this role, and like, mm-hmm, I would say the same. And just before we, you know, in preparation for this recording, I was kind of perusing, yep, the Wikipedia page for this show, just, mm-hmm, to kind of refresh my memory about certain, yep, things. And like, it kind of surprised me that like most of the cast are certainly like actors who I've never seen, aside, mm-hmm, from like big celebrity cameos that we, mm-hmm, get into in later episodes. But it's, you know, I was looking through kind of, you know, in Wikipedia, when you hover your cursor over the other, like, mm-hmm, hyperlinked other pages, you kind of just see like the first, mm-hmm, little bit. So I was doing that with each of the actors, not clicking into their page, just looking at the blurb. And most of them are best known for this show, not very successful show that only lasted two seasons. And like, that's a shame, because they're all so talented, and I feel like they should all be in so many more things. And I'm sure they've, to varying degrees, all had interesting careers in other ways. But yes, I kind of feel like the lack of big celebrity star power, at least in the main cast, is kind of part of the charm of this whole endeavor.
It totally is.
You know, you have like other shows that are like, you know, short-lived or unceremoniously canceled, that you kind of think like, oh, well, you liked watching that first season of Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place. Well, that was Ryan Reynolds's big start. And like, okay, that kind of tends to overtake the show that you remember enjoying, because, well, that actor became big after, and that's all anybody remembers about this show. But I kind of love how we can, because the cast didn't really explode into major fame after this, we can kind of, mm-hmm, treat it on its own terms in a little way.
Yeah.
And, yeah, anyway, that's just a funny thought that occurred to me.
That's a very good observation. I mean, that is what helps kind of the guest stars really stand out in this that make them really memorable. Like we have Matt Lucas, we have Weird Al shows up as a monk.
John Stamos will be in episode 2, which we'll talk about next
John
week.
John Stamos shows up. You have Hugh Bonneville from Downton Abbey as the pirate captain. Like there's going to be quite a few big names that are going to show up in this that are definitely going to allow for them to have the bigger spotlight momentarily, is because the rest of the cast is such a good kind of cohesive supporting unit of not big name people, but definitely people that should definitely do more because they are fantastic. I think Vinnie Jones out of the entire main cast is probably the biggest.
Probably because he had one memorable, memeable line in an X-Men movie.
That's right.
Is the main thing other than this that I knew him from. Yeah. Like, now that you mentioned that he was on an episode of Elementary, I'm like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that, but because I did watch that show. Yeah, but anyway, I kind of just love that the cast has this sort of B-level charm to it in the best possible way.
Yes. And so, speaking of the rest of the cast, we'll cover just our other, we'll finish out the two main couples, and then we'll come back to Jareth and Sid in later episodes when they have bigger parts to play.
Cool.
But so we have Timothy Amundsen as King Richard, Ryan.
Yeah.
What do you think of King Richard? I mean, first of all, a perfect Shakespearean name, King Richard. I mean, that right there just sends certain images into one's head.
Okay, I'm just going to get this out of the way now. Richard's my favorite. Richard is everybody's favorite. Yes. You can't watch the show and not love Richard. And again, that's another like big twist that the show gives you, is because when we first meet him, he seems like a textbook, you know, mustache twirling villain who you're not supposed to like. He's, you know, literally kidnapping the main character's love interest in the first scene he's introduced in. But he's just so pathetic, and that makes him so lovable. And, you know, It does not take long for you, the viewer, to realize that, okay, there's so much more going on with this character, that he's got a lot of layers. Yes. He's definitely not the villain that he may have pegged himself to be, in addition to us pegging him to be. That, you know, he comes into the story just thinking, like, I'm the king, I'll kill whoever I want, I'll marry whoever I want, because that's the privilege of being me. But then we will very quickly learn why he feels this way, what made him this way, and his whole backstory is so well done that, you know, I guess this is a big spoiler for where the series is going, but by the time we get to season 2, he's just part of like the main good guy cast, that they completely drop all pretenses of the fact that he was supposed to be the villain.
Well, I mean, he kind of is like the comedic version of Prince Humperdinck, where, you know, he's menacing when he wants to be. Like, there's the whole great scene where they're about to go to the marriage scene, and he comes into Madeline's room and does the, "So you'll be mine, you know, after the wedding, we will do it." And then it's the, "But first of all, we'll have some gifts, and then we'll do it." And you know what "do it" means. Like, Timothy had such a, like, once again, the comedic timing of having to do this role just right. So you get the sympathy, but also you're hitting the comedic beats of the scene. Like, he is doing a lot of heavy lifting to make this character more than just a one-dimensional, sappy kind of mama's boy type character that could easily could fall in that type of caricature very quickly with this. And so the fact, and I mean, like, just the simple thing of, there's the great scene where he gets served tea by the chef, and it's the whole thing of, is there lemon in this tea? And the chef already set up like, "You've killed my father and my grandfather. Is this what I die for? Is some extra lemon in the tea?" He does the sorry. He goes, "That's lovely.
Yes.
Thank you." And then he gets right back to, you know, threatening the king and queen of Valencia with the, "I'll rip your kingdom apart to find the jewel, and I'll kill you in the process," right? Like, he's playing so many great levels, and he has a really terrific song, which we will get into.
Yeah. For this. I also just want to add, like, in that scene that you mentioned, the, "Okay, and then we're going to do it." Like, even that, like, it's the first, you know, moment of, like, actual dialogue with this character. Yeah. We've seen him, you know, briefly, like, on screen, but he just kind of seems like this menacing cardboard cutout at that point. But then this, it's such a good introduction to him as an actual character, because it does show how pathetic he is, and just like how, like, slimy and silly he is. But it doesn't quite yet tip the hand of revealing the whole cards of how, oh, okay, it's sort of like, it's very plausible that, okay, he's just a gross guy who the only way you can get someone to marry you and have sex with you is by kidnapping them. And it still is very much in villain territory, even though we're like, okay, he's a villain, but he's a very pathetic villain.
And so, even
by the end of this first episode, we're getting a lot more from his perspective, but it's still very much in you're the bad guy, and oh no, Gallimand is, you know, on his way to come into your trap. Like, we still have reason to be afraid of him, even if we recognize that he alone is silly and pathetic.
Yes.
But he has
It's kind of like Prince John in all the Robin Hood stories. You know, like you got the Sheriff of Nottingham or Lord Guy Hamilton in there, who's kind of like the main henchman thug Jareth character. Then you got the Prince John character, who's very kind of, you know, more effeminate. Definitely not as masculine, kind of a bit more, not like I kind of has other people do the violent deeds, and he kind of can sit back and just do the take him away, you know.
Taxes, kind of,
yes,
which he
exactly.
has a line in this about how his favorite pastime is raising taxes, so that's fun,
right? So, yeah, we're definitely gonna get more into him and Tad Cooper in later.
Tad Cooper, and that's not till season two,
But definitely, there's definitely, like, Timothy does such a good job setting this character up and then just really having some fun playing this role, where you can see just how much fun he has bouncing between, you know, villainy meets, you know, comedy. And then you see some of the softer underbelly of who this man really is, and that he really is kind of more putting up a persona for the sake of, you know, presenting himself to the world in such a way because he feels that is his job in the story, and how he kind of has to break that mold to become the proper king in the end. So, you know, that's a longer journey. But next we'll talk about Mallory Jansen, who plays Queen Madalena. Ryan, what do you think about our Queen Madalena?
Yeah, she's great.
She actually, behind Vinnie Jones, she's had the biggest kind of career. Like, she's been on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Okay.
As Madame Hydra. She's done Baby Daddy, Young and Hungry. She's done, she's Quantum or The Big Leap. This Is Us. She did some episodes of This Is Us.
That makes sense.
American Housewife. Like, she's done a lot of, she's been working steadily.
Nice. Yeah, like, she's great. She's very much, she, similar to what we were just talking about with Richard, about how he plays all the different sides of this character very well, the version you expect and then the version he turns out to be. She does a great job of, with very little lines or screen time, setting up that, oh, you think she's this perfect damsel, the one who needs saving, and then very quickly reveals herself to be, oh, I'm the actual villain of the story.
Yes.
And I think, like, that's just, it's such a clever subversion of this typical fairy tale princess bride type format, but also, you know, you really need a good actor who can pull off that switch. And I think she does that so well. And you could just tell watching her that she revels in being the baddie, because, like, pretty ladies like that rarely get to be, at least in this way. And so, like, it's just fun. I think, you know, she, I would have loved to be a fly on the wall when she, like, got the script of this first episode, just be like, oh, okay, this is so much better than the version of this character I would usually play in a fairy tale. And we'll probably keep coming back to this throughout the series. But she is just such a fun presence in just how bad she's able to be and how much she revels in it.
It's true. And I mean, she's kind of like the anti-Guinevere in many ways. Like, Guinevere, as much as she does spark a civil war with her affair with Lancelot, is very much demure and intelligent and kind, and really is Arthur's kind of right hand and his kind of counterbalance. Here, Madalena, she's wonderfully vile. But we will get more into her backstory too. Like, don't just let her be vile for the sake of being vile. There is more to her. And then you kind of have to go back to the opening song, which you realize she does the turn and says, actually, you know, jewels, crowns, like, you know, getting to do the royal thing, not living as a peasant, kind of makes you go, was she with Gallivant for love to begin with? Or did she see Gallivant as a raise up in class because he was the best knight in the realm, and therefore she would have been his lady? And Ari would have been elevated in their kind of middle class, gentry level setting of the knights, you know? So it's kind of one of those things where, did she ever really love Gallivant to begin with, or was she more using him as a stepping stool on her way up out of kind of the ditch, as it were.
And I think later episodes give, if not definitive answers to that question, more evidence one way or the other. So maybe we'll unpack those as we go. But
we will.
But yes, I think it's a good thing that this first episode really does seed and make you wonder about as we go on.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, like, just some of the joyful yelling she does at King Richard there, where the gallivant would have done this already.
First she says it under her breath, and then when he asks her to repeat, you expect her to be like, nothing, but she wants him to hear it.
She gives it to him. And then the fact that, like, she's a very openly sexual character, like, she's not playing a character that is chaste and, you know, demure, kind of like what princesses are expected to be in the stories. Like, she is, like, full on having affairs. Like, there's one scene coming up in the later episode of the season where she's auditioning men to be her to be her new lover, and has lined up out the door, you know. And, like, the fact that, like, as I said, the opening song, she's literally having orgasmic reactions to Gallivant several times a day, and it, like, they don't shy away from that side of her character. Like, she is very much more a contemporary raunchy version, like, even more than Dare Buttercup. In Princess Bride, who is very kind of demurred and is the traditional damsel in distress, with, like, some cheek to her too. Like, she does have some agency, but not as much as Madalena, who we will see in the end of the season takes some big swings in her rise for power, you know. But she's wonderful. And then rounding out our foursome of the main couplings is Karen David, who, we should note, studied at Ryerson.
Oh, back in Toronto, the 90s. Metropolitan University.
Sorry, yes, Toronto Metropolitan University now. As Princess Isabella Maria Lucia Elisabetta of Valencia.
Yes, the full name, which I struggled to remember all of the pieces of, as is part of the running gag. We can just call her Izzy.
Yes, exactly. So we have the wonderful Karen David. So, Ryan, what did you think of our dear Izzy?
Yeah, again, she's great. Everyone's great in this show. Part of what makes the show so great, but yes, she's the perfect, you know, foil to Madalena, which is very important. I think, you know, there's no surprises that surely she's going to become a love interest to Gallivant, but she's a very capable one. She's no damsel in distress herself, even if she's pretending to be one for the sake of luring Gallivant back to Valencia. But, you know, we'll see more of this as early as the next episode, where she helps him get his groove back on at the jousting tournament. So no big spoilers there, but she's very much a subversive modern princess who is very capable in her own right and willing to get her hands dirty when she needs to. And the fact that we are given this big, you know, bait and switch where we think that, oh, she's seeking Gallivant's help, but actually she's luring him back, really does thread the needle well of, oh, we don't know if we can trust her, or we know we can't trust her for this reason, but we also understand her motivations, which really gives her a lot of great secrets to play with in various different scenes as this relationship starts to unfold.
Yeah, I mean, she really is the kind of, like, the contemporary princess, very kind of, like, she definitely doesn't take it. We see in her first reprise,
where is the gallant knight who stood for truth and right? The valiant dragon slayer Gallivant. Where is his steely gaze? The abs of poets praise. Whatever happened to that Gallivant?
She is very kind of not soft-spoken, but not as assertive as she's going to become. But then by the end of it, when she sees Gallivant isn't what she was expecting, she really does kind of change her gear and show how tactile she is, where she changes tack and kind of gives him a kick in the ass a bit to get him back up and running. And, you know, she's going to have a lot of great work with Joshua, where they're going to have to do a lot of playoff with each other, you know. And you see that set up already, and you already can see, once again, the predictability in the show. There are some elements that are really predictable, and then there's some you don't see coming, which is really nice. But, like, obviously you see right off the top of, oh, Gallivant and Izzy are the ones that are going to be the couple that are destined to be together, because clearly Madalena is not who she's going to be expected to be, with the classic damsels to be rescued, waiting by the window for Gallivant to come riding back, you know. So it's going to be one of those things of, oh, okay, this is where we're going with this. And of course, as you said, the great twist of this first season, for the first part of the season anyway, is that she's luring Gallivant back into a trap. So we're going to see a lot of great kind of aside Shakespearean asides where she even makes reference to later. I was telegraphing what I was feeling and thinking about my betrayal the whole time. And you just didn't hear me, you know? So it's one of those great things where we're already seeing some setup of that. And just, once again, she's a multi-layered character. Like Dan Fogelman did a really great job of crafting characters that he kind of took the concept of them and then contemporized and expanded upon them and kind of gave them a really nice rounded out performance there. Yeah. And really gives them a lot to play with. Because, you know, this is very kind of Sondheim's Into the Woods meets Spamalot meets Camelot, right? It's one of those things of we're going to take something you know, but then we're going to twist it in such a way that you're going to see it all in a new way. And that's a lot of fun. So, yeah. All right. So now let's get into some of the songs. So notably, we have the title song,
which brings us to today, the royal wedding day. No one can stop it now at Gallifant. Poor Madeleine awaits behind King Richard's gates for the arrival of her Gallifant. Now, at last begins a true adventure. Epic, wild, a real hot adventure. So, huzzah and tally-ho, sit back and hear me.
That is described, and I'll read it directly from the interview listed on the Wikipedia page because it is very funny the way they describe it. Mencken described this with Slater, the other composer he works with, as a self-knowing parody of songs. So that right there kind of sets you up for exactly kind of what it's going to be. And so, Ryan, what do you think of the opening title song that's going to come back? I mean, we have two reprises of this song in this first episode. So what did you think of it?
Like, it's funny because you could listen to this song without paying close attention to the lyrics and it just sounds like a classic hero introduction yeah. song. And the way that it keeps repeating, not just in this episode but throughout this whole first season, is very much that this is the theme or motif of yeah. Gallivant himself. And it's just so classic hero music. It will you know, it took a long time for it to no longer be stuck in my head after all previous viewings, and now of course, it's going to be back stuck in my head. But I love it. So, you know, you can stay in my head. Fun song. that's fine by me. Yes. But then when you do listen closely to the lyrics, you realize that, yeah, that's where this kind of like tongue-in-cheek parody-ness of it all really plays in. That the things that they're singing about is just, it's so over the top, and like what the things, the qualities that make him this big heroic figure. I know you remember the specific jokes better than I do.
Cahoney is out to there.
Yes.
The hero with perfect hair. Hooray. He ruled in every way. Mm-hmm. And people called him Gallivant. Like it's very kind of broad and self-serving. Like it's like right away in that first song, you get what the humor is going to be. It's very Princess Bride. We're going to do a lot of winks to the audience. Where we are going to break the fourth wall. The fourth wall is going to be broken in this show, and you're going to get it played to you a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things of who are these people talking to when you're, you know, you're roaming through the village and you hear them talking about Gallivant. It's like, oh, well, they're talking to us. They're kind of doing, I mean, this is very Mencken doing a kind of redone version of Belle from Beauty and the Beast. Open up with the village, and the village is doing everything they can to set up who the heck is Belle in this world. And this is the same thing of who is Gallivant at the start of this story. He is this guy who is kind of the all-star football player, a trophy man who is the hero of the story, your traditional knight in shining armor.
But I guess the difference between this song and something like Belle is Belle is all about how she doesn't fit into her community.
Yes.
That everyone's singing about how strange she is. She reads books. She you know, doesn't want to marry Gaston, who we all want to marry. Like, it's very much...
What's wrong with her? She's crazy. He's gorgeous.
Yeah, but like, it's interesting because, you know, I know I said earlier that I don't know a lot about musicals or have no expertise, but I do know in this kind of traditional template of this classic musical mold that the Disney Renaissance movies that Menken worked on all seem to follow, is that we get an opening number that sets up the community, and then we get our heroes' I Want song, where they sing all about how they don't fit in within that community. And that's that kind of, you know, so much of the American musical proper is about this opposition between the community who sings chorally and the hero who sings alone, and how they don't fit. But this is, I guess, a bit of a subversion of that, is that we are introduced to our hero through the community singing his praises, that he is very much belonging in this community, but it's not actually about his tension with them. It's actually more of an internal struggle of him needing to find himself and get his groove back after he's been through a great loss of romantic prospects.
And I mean, this is very much, if you listen to the title song of Camelot, which is Camelot.
Camelot, Camelot, I know it sounds a bit bizarre, but in Camelot, Camelot, that's how conditions are.
Camelot, I know what gives.
I'm going to go on the record, I've never seen Camelot, so.
Right, you have to listen to that soundtrack.
I know, sorry. As you keep bringing it up, I feel like I should probably confess this sooner right before it gets really embarrassing later on.
Off mic, I will show you Camelot.
I have read the original Arthurian legends, at least the versions that are compiled by Thomas Malory, but no, I've obviously seen Monty Python's and the Holy Grail like a million times, but no, I've never seen or listened to the soundtrack of the musical Camelot. I will not get any of these references you're making, but please continue enlightening me.
Well, hopefully between throughout at some point in this first season, you will listen to the album of Camelot so you can hear what I am referencing. But the title song of Camelot, which is has the line of Camelot, I know it gives a person pause, but in Camelot, those are the legal laws. And then it goes into the sun will never set before the sundown. Like it's very, you know, but it's brassy. It's all about the reaching of this aspiring kingdom, and Galavant's the same way. Galavant, Galavant, like when Richard sings it, you really hear that this is a character who has a long journey. He is not a completed person. Like, yes, he's getting all the praise of the world, but we know from this first episode where we hear he wasn't open to love. He gets a broken heart. Like, he has a lot of self repair, and probably there is, I mean, some uncertainty in him where he is fulfilling a role that is given to him by society, right? Like he shows up at the wedding to stop the wedding, doing the traditional hero speech, and then gets kind of nut punched by Maddalena. And she says, no thanks, you know? So it's one of those things where he's fulfilling the role, but then is kind of, the song is setting up that, oh, maybe there's something more here, because the melodic line isn't ending on a perfect end, like on a perfect fifth or a perfect fourth. It's kind of going up to the sixth that's coming. It's going off just a little bit to the non-perfect ending chord of the triad there. It's going a little bit off just so then, you know, you can feel a bit of it's not fully resolved. So you're still eager to kind of hear what's going to come next in the story. So,
yeah,
it's really well done.
Something I would even add, like, again, correct me if I'm wrong, because as I just said, I'm not overly familiar with Camelot, the musical, but if we're comparing these opening numbers, it's I think interesting that one of them is about a place and the other is about a person. Like, and I think if we're talking about setting up the hero and their journey here, it's what I think you've just described about Camelot is more about the ideal that this place represents, and the song is very much about the ideal that Galavant represents, even if, as we see, the person himself maybe doesn't live up to that, as we're very much introduced to in this 1 year later, even if he once was that person, and it's all about reclaiming that ideal and being the Galavant that we all sung about him being in the opening number.
Well, that's exactly it. Like Camelot sets up the idealist, the ideal version of this kingdom that, spoiler alert, doesn't, like, it fails because humankind refuses to let perfection win the day. And Galavant's the same way, where you set up this idyllic, way back in days of old, there was a hero told about a man called Galavant, square jaw and perfect hair, cojones out to there. There was no man quite like Galavant, right? Like, you're setting up this paragon of virtue, this Adonis of a man. And then after the opening song, what happens to him? He has 1 year later, he's drinking 20 kegs a day. He's in the dumps. You know, he is just absolutely depressed. And he's kind of lost his way. And it's going to do all those things of, he as a character has to spend these next two seasons fighting, like fighting his self-doubts and his own family issues, which we get more into season two about. But this whole opening song sets up kind of this idealized version, but the music kind of gives a bit of a twist to it, where if you're listening really closely to the melodic line, you'll hear that it doesn't quite finish perfectly. It's off by a little bit, just enough if you listen to it well, you'll hear it. And then the other song is a King Richard song, which is She'll Be Mine.
Oh, what kind of man is just complete perfection? Gow never lose his temper.
Won't that be divine? And she'll be mine, just mine, all mine, mine, all mine, all mine.
Oh, that was ripping.
Which, you know, is a wonderful villain soliloquy meets a I want song. Because he says, I want to shoot him with a crossbow. I want to shove things when the sun doesn't shine. You know, like he talks all about the things he wants to do to Galavant. It's setting up this villainous I want, which is something rare. Very rarely do we get an I want song from a villain. It's more of a about me song. Right. It's not so much saying, and I want, it's a who am I? It's kind of like a I am this. Uh-huh. You know, Bill Sykes comes in Oliver and sings My Name.
What's bad? What's they gonna turn in hell? I'll be there at burning. Meanwhile, think of what I'm earning, all on account of my name. What is it? What is it? What is it?
And it's not, I want Nancy. It's, I'm living up to what my name represents in the world, which is this horrible thuggish man who's going to shank you in the alley and rob you, right? Like Sir Richard, King Richard here is doing the exact opposite. He's saying, I want her to be mine. And this is what I want to do it.
Well, you know? I think there's kind of a, it's really interesting you bring that up, because it's a very clear reason why we've subverted traditional musical forms here, is that we haven't actually subverted them, because contrary to what we might expect, Richard's not the villain. He's, that's one right. might even argue, the protagonist or secondary protagonist of the series. Yeah. And, you know, it is very interesting that the first I Want song we get comes from him, because he's the one whose journey we're going to follow, at least, you know, as he gets a lot of character growth in tandem with Galavant. And then they're basically a buddy duo by season two. But it went.
The hero's BFF.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's also interesting that if we just think in, like, you know, screenwriting 101, the whole want versus need thing that, you know, you've probably heard of before, is that he's singing his I want about how all he wants to do is kill Galavant, but he doesn't need to kill Galavant. That's not the need that this character, he just needs love. He needs respect, and he's not getting either of those things from his wife, because she keeps comparing him to Galavant, specifically just to mess with him and to get what she wants from him, not because she actually thinks that Galavant's necessarily better, or maybe she does, but it's not actually about this comparison as much as it is just to taunt him and then allow her to manipulate him. So it's very well done that not only are we giving our, you know, supposed villain and I want song as a way of forecasting that maybe he's not going to be the villain, but also really digging deep down into the villainous seeming thing that he's singing about is really just a cover for the thing that he actually is going to need and grow around as the series progresses around him.
Right. Well, that's exactly it. You're hitting it right on the head with it's setting up. There is more to him. He's not your typical villain of the story, even though he is thinking about doing some awful things to Galavant. Deep down, we know, is this really what you want, or are you just wanting to take your anger out on someone because there's a bigger issue here? That it has to be addressed in the story.
And the fact that it's cloaked in a song that's all about wanting to murder your enemies, it doesn't give up the game so fast that, oh, this is a traditional I Want song and he isn't a villain. Like, it very much, this seems like the kind of thing a villain would sing. But like you said, most villains don't sing about wanting to kill their enemies. They're just very bombastic. Oh, Radigan, look at me.
Yeah. Or be prepared. You know, it's very kind of like, this is my villain plan. This is what, or I mean, again, you go back to Oklahoma in the Lonely Room, right? That Judd Fry sings.
I ain't gonna dream about her arms no more. I ain't gonna leave her alone. Going outside, get myself a bride. Get me a woman to call my own.
Before he goes off to the date with Lori, he's singing about, you know, he wants a real woman in his room. That's all he wants. He just wants physical attention. Like, he's not giving you a deeper insight into who he is. And
I guess we could even say, like, Judd is another, again, I don't like this musical, but we can say that, he's also like, is this guy really the villain? Is he just kind of ostracized by his society? Like, it's so weird to me that Oklahoma is supposedly like the first or one of the first big musicals that's supposedly set the form or the templates in place, yet it doesn't seem to follow any of what we would recognize as these traditional forms. Anyway.
But yeah, and I mean, also, we just have to give a shout out to Vinnie Jones in this song, who, along with the whole chorus of ensemble members, who are just hamming it up with Richard in this scene, like the chorus doing the la 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 la's, or Garrus, everybody sing!
Then she'll be mine.
Everybody sing!
Distracting your pride.
We could start a genocidal war.
Wait, what?
I'll get back to all my hobbies, like raising taxes and tormenting the poor.
And then he's doing the daisy chain kind of deadpan with Richard and the other guard. It's great. And then also just throwing around the chef in the scene as well. Like, it's just the physical comedy of that number is so great. And once again, it's just winning you on side of Richard, even though, yes, he's saying horrible things, but Charles is like, I like this guy.
Yeah, he's too much fun to hate. Yeah, he's clearly too much fun to hate is exactly what it's doing. And like, I love what you just said about Gareth. You know, everybody sing is, you know, you don't necessarily recognize this right away on a first viewing, but Gareth has such a deep personal affection for Richard. And, you know, as we learn more about both of their shared backstory, we learn to, you know, we learn why, and it makes sense. But it's just something I find charming about him, even in these early episodes before we learn why that's the case. That is just like, your boss wants to have a big musical number about killing his enemies, and you're going to indulge that. And like, he doesn't have to. He could just let Richard sing this song. Richard's not saying, everybody sing with me. Gareth, threaten them until they do. But Gareth's just like, well, you want to have a musical number? I'm going to give you the best gosh darn musical number you could imagine.
It's true. And that's exactly it. I mean, Gareth and Richard's relationship is going to be one that is well sustained throughout the whole show, even though in the second season they are apart for a majority of that time.
But what
there
makes
is
that
a lasting
work,
impact with each other.
And what makes that really work well is the last scene they have together in season one, which we'll get to in a bit. But that is what really, if you didn't see it coming already, is what sells that, these two people really care about each other. And that propels us into they're separate, and we hope they will come back to each other at some point.
Yeah, exactly. So the last thing we'll talk about before we sign off for this first episode is, Ryan, we know where the story is going, and this is your third time seeing the pilot. What are your thoughts of this as a solo pilot episode? And then how do you feel it sets up the rest of the show and where it's going to ultimately end up?
Yeah, well, this episode really is just pure setup. It sets up the backstory, the whole 1 year earlier sequence that sets the characters' journey in this motion. And setting up the, here's where all the chess pieces of the characters are to what will ultimately be a clash at the end of the season. So in terms of how does this work as a pilot episode, it does exactly what a pilot should do, and in very little time with two big musical numbers, which is quite impressive. That, yeah, it's really great, and we get to know all of the characters on some level. Like I said, characters like Gareth and Sid, we don't get like a full view of who they are or how they fit into this, but we get little bits and pockets here and there, yeah, that will, you know, just enough that we were interested in them and that will, you know, kind of be intrigued to pick up more pieces as we go. But yeah, I think this is just really good at, yep, this is who all these people are, while this is also kind of setting up the intriguing, quite subversive situation that they find themselves in, that, you know, if there's two moments in this episode that make you think, oh, that's not what I was expecting, then it does a really good job of making you intrigued and wanting you to come back for more. Even if we, like, you know, we'll talk next week about how episode two is the one that really, I think, sets the tone for what the show itself is like, you know, in terms of these very, like, episodic adventures that each episode follows, episodic episodes, so it makes sense. You know, we talked a lot when we did Nicholas Nickleby together about the episodic nature of the ways that it was divided into hour-long increments for British television, and that's how we were encountering it in those hour-long increments. And there was always this kind of question of, you know, do these work as episodic units when the whole play was just two nights of theater that people would watch in one go, one very long go? So, you know, we were kind of grafting episodicness onto it to see, well, we're encountering it episodically. Does it work as that? Do we think this functions like television should? And, you know, we don't have to do that here because they're already divided into episodes. And I think they know very well how to use that 22-minute form very efficiently. And, you know, it's amazing to me that these episodes are as short as they are and accomplish so much. So, yeah, I love this episode. It's maybe not even... it's probably not the best episode in the series, but I think it's the best at doing exactly what a pilot should.
Exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right, where this is a very episodic yet serialized show where the team knew exactly where to leave off each episode. So you were super eager to get back for the next episode. Like, I was already ready to start episode two last night when I was rewatching this for our recording. Even though I know what's going to happen, some of those things of you're still so eager to get to the next episode because you know there's going to be great songs and more fun with the characters. And just the story's been set up really well in this first episode of the whole backstory of Gallivant and Madalena and Richard are all set up so you know exactly what's going on between the three of them. You also have Izzy setting up her villainous, or not villainous, a duplicitous situation that she's in. You know, then you also have some of the great side characters like Sid and Gareth and the chef all introduced in this episode as well. You know, like, it's one of these great kind of things where everything's being set up perfectly for a return visit for the next episode. And I mean, looking ahead and how we know how the show shapes up, this does a great job of setting up who these characters are going to be. I mean, setting up the trajectory of Madalena. And how she's really go on a dark journey here, you know, compared to Richard, who's ultimately going to turn, do kind of almost a 180 from what you see in this first episode with him to something he's going to be completely different by the end of the first season. You know, like, it's setting up a really good job of setting up where this story is going to go and kind of what each character needs to do along the way. You know, like, set up very easy that Gallivant needs to get his mojo back. Isabella's got to save her kingdom, but to do that, she's got to be a little bit duplicitous to get Gallivant back in action. Richard's put a plan into motion that we'll see if that works out for him. But, you know, it's one of those things of clearly this is a man that's got some issues and is not quite all what he appears to be, you know. And Madalena has gone from being the damsel, traditional damsel in distress, to now being a truly miserable queen of the realm who is just out for homicidal genocide. You know, but yeah, it's really great. I mean, this is a really good kickoff episode, and I cannot wait to do the rest of the season with you. We have 8 episodes this season, and I believe 10 in the next season. So we will definitely be going down into these episodes. And I mean, we'll sign off for now. Tune in next week where we will do episode 2. Ryan, before we go, as I say on Cup of Hemlock, give us that classic Ryan Borokovich send off.
Well, my classic send-off is that no point trying to follow me on social media because I'm not active very on it. But hey, since we're not currently on Cup of Hemlock, let's just direct people to Cup of Hemlock. If you like me, that's where you can hear all of my theater thoughts, you know, less about musicals, if that's what this fan base is mostly interested in. But, you know, I have thoughts about other things too. So just go to check out Cup of Hemlock. We're at COH Theater on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We're Cup of Hemlock Theater on YouTube and all the podcast platforms. Check us out there. That's where our content lives. And we review things, we interview things. It's a grand time. And Max there too. And you clearly yes. are big fans of him.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. As I always say, you can follow me at Mackenzie on all social media platforms. You can also follow all our other antics over at Cup of Hemlock's YouTube channel, as well as podcast feed, where you can see more fun theater antics there. Ryan and I have some great editorials coming up, where we will be diving into such things as what we do on the Cup, as well as our thoughts on theater etiquette. So, you know, we have a lot of fun there. So definitely something fun to check out. But yeah, until then, everybody, stay healthy. Stay safe, and we will see you all in the next episode. Thanks. Bye.
But anyway, hi-ho, we're off and here we go. Come back for next week's show to see what's next for guys.